to advertise, email podcast@thisisvechi.com.
Release yourself from order and logic and enter a new place. It's not work. It's not home. Here, no maps have been drawn. No books have been written. Nothing is certain. Everything is possible. Welcome to podcast and chill with Matt G.
I'm assuming this doesn't end well.
From shaping how we search to influencing how we learn, work, and even think, technology companies today don't just build tools, they build systems. And at the center of that in South Africa is Kabelo Makwane, country director for Google South Africa. This is a man whose career spans global tech giants, boardrooms, and public institutions. He's now tasked with leading one of the most powerful digital platforms in the world, right here at home. But in a country that's still grappling with inequality, unemployment, and a fast-changing digital economy, the question isn't just what technology can do. It's who it really is working for. Kabelo Makwane, welcome. But I think let's start around the issue of technology. You know, when you look at sort of us young Black South Africans, we never got an opportunity to really grow up around technology.
Yeah.
How was that transition for you, you know, as you were growing up, seeing how sort of technology is involved or has evolved over time?
Yeah, no, it's McFarlane, it's not been an easy road, right? You know, to your point, I didn't grow up with technology. The first time I saw a computer was in a computer lab in, you know, in varsity. And I encountered this thing, black screen with a blinking cursor. And I was like, okay, so what do we do here now? And I was supposed to submit an assignment and, yes, you know, and programming and all of that. But fast forward now, I think it's all about curiosity. Like, I took a curious approach to technology, and I think over time, you know, technology has evolved from something that was very, very restrictive in terms of adoption. The barriers were high. Like, if you didn't know how to use a QWERTY keyboard, you know, or use, you know, programming language, computer language, it was very, very difficult to interact with technology. You know, today we are kind of like in the era of touch, you know. People are touching and scrolling and screaming and streaming and searching, etc. And it's actually much, much easier to use technology, and it's evolving at a rapid pace. And, you know, we talk about today being, you know, in this inflection point with AI becoming literally the next, you know, evolution as significant as the Industrial Revolution, right? Because it's affecting every facet of our lives and how we interact with technology in, you know, in our day-to-day, you know, from work to how we live, how we socialize, and how we play as well, right? So it's incredible, and it's something that I'm very passionate in, just making sure that nobody gets left behind, right? And a big piece of what, you know, we concern ourselves about is about how do we create awareness, how do we, you know, build skills, you know, for people to really, really make this a meaningful technology and a meaningful era in the things that they cherish and love to do the most. That's what we are concerned about.
You speak about your first interaction with a computer, right?
Yeah.
And ideally that was your sort of first interaction with technology.
Yeah.
Cell phones, right?
Yes.
Cell phones came in and they changed the way the world works.
Yes.
I mean, I still feel like there's got to be some sort of rule that's put in, because now I must listen to 5-minute WhatsApp voice notes from my mother who greets Ntate Dumela and greets back Likai, et cetera, you know what I mean? But the evolution even of sort of cell phone technology,
yeah,
coming into, yeah, places far and wide in South Africa,
yeah,
what impact has that had with the way in which we consume technology?
Yeah, it's such an important point, Fallon, that you highlight, because one of the issues that we had as a continent, let alone South Africa, is that we were left out of the industrialization era, and therefore, you know, a lot of the infrastructure build-outs that happened, you know, way back when, almost 2 decades ago, we missed those, right? And so a lot of the telcos were playing catch up in kind of building out, you know, point-to-point connectivity infrastructure, right? Underpinning that as well was the lack of, you know, sustainable power. So energy is a big, big limiting factor. So from an access perspective, cell phones have actually become really an equalizing factor for the continent. And we are technically a mobile-first continent. And hence why you see also that a lot of the fintech companies who have been successful have adopted mobile-first strategies.
Yes.
We've innovated in a way that I think the rest of the world is actually taking note and also learning from us, digital services, let alone fintech, you know, in terms of social services, etc. Because we were addressing real problems, we were addressing real challenges.
And using
how do I actually send money in a way that's fast, that's cost effective, etc., and in an affordable, easy to access type of way.
You've had an opportunity to work across many, many countries, worked in various companies and in your different roles. When we speak expansion, is it always about leaving where you are, or is it about going somewhere and bringing back? What does expansion look like to you, especially from a digital perspective?
A very critical topic right now, and one that I think we have to approach it with like wide eyes, is that we need to be conscious about being net exporters as opposed to net importers. In the context of expanding, let's call it the pervasiveness of technology, we have an opportunity for local innovation and local content, right? There are a lot of very, very smart innovators across the continent, people who've come up with very, very clever tech. The question is, how do they scale and how do they actually attract the right kind of investment so that those innovations can find resonance and also markets outside of our context. The piece about bringing technology, importing technology, will be there for quite some time, because obviously with big tech comes big investments.
Yes.
We are in the era now where I think the last figure I read was like close to about $780 billion. Dollars that are going into AI investments.
Yes.
Around manufacturing TPUs and GPUs and making sure that technology becomes pervasive and accessible and also scaled across the world. Those companies are throwing big money after that. So when you consider the scale of that investment, obviously it becomes a limiting factor just in terms of big tech and big play. So there will be a component of it which has to be imported. But I think there's also the opportunity to leverage these platforms to build, let's call it localized innovation, and then also then start to make that mainstream and scale, right? It's a perennial challenge of how we actually unlock the youth dividend.
Yes.
In the African context,
And we're lucky in that because we've got such a huge, huge population of youth in Africa, something that, we pride ourselves in when we look at, things like, innovation, when we look at things like where Africa is going. We still have a very, very huge youth market, and that makes it more easier because then adoption
yeah.
becomes a lot more easier because youth are a lot more inquisitive.
Yeah.
They'll play around a lot more with technology as opposed to everyone else. There's something quite interesting that you've done as Google, and you've sort of developed AI tools into African languages,
yes.
right? Which is obviously something very, very big, because we always speak about localization. Language shouldn't be a barrier to technology.
Yeah.
It isn't everywhere else in the world. Now it's good that it's coming to South Africa.
Yeah.
And that now, that speaks to inclusion,
yeah.
which is something that's quite important.
Absolutely.
But with inclusion also comes influence,
yes.
right? How do you balance the two?
Look, there's no way that, because at the core of what we call frontier models, mm-hmm. right, these large language models, and Gemini being a big frontier model from a Google point of view, at the core of it is around contextual relevance, right? because it's a conversational engagement, it does not make sense for McFarlane to engage with the tool that will not understand context as well as the content together, right? Yes. So when you prompt these tools today and you say, give me a picture that represents a typical sort of market in Africa, it will give you the quintessential stereotypical picture, right? Because we need to enrich these models with things that make sense to us and that are not stereotyping the African scenario. Because Africa is a tapestry of different settings and so on, right?
You raise a very important point, and I'm so sorry to take there. Because, you know, I can't remember. I think it was Cassius Lubisi.
Yeah.
We had him here on the platform, and he spoke about us then also playing a role in feeding that machine.
Exactly.
Which is where there's a big disconnect. In fact, it was Thembi Safakude. Mm-hmm. Thembi Safakude came out. He used to be with Al Jazeera and etc. Yeah, yeah. And he said, we need to start feeding that model. You know, for example, you Google someone like Steve Biko, you know, there's two or three lines.
Yes.
You know, whereas there's a lot of information that needs to now be fed into the machine so that when somebody in Norway Googles Steve Biko or wants some sort of information around Steve Biko, then there's a wealth of knowledge that comes through. And that's where we're also missing it when it comes to localization.
Exactly. Very importantly to your point, there's an accurate representation of culture, ethos, you know, values,
nuance.
And also icons and nuances, right? Mm. Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly it. And language is the embodiment of culture. And that's why I'm saying, you know, with this endeavor around localization with languages, we've done 25 African languages. Of course, in South Africa, it's isiZulu, Afrikaans, English by default, of course, and we continue to broaden that out. The reality of it, though, is that every single language represents a subset or some form of cultural ethos, which shouldn't be lost.
Yes.
And that's where, to your earlier question, we can start to influence culturally the rest of the world, right? Because we have really, really rich tapestry in terms of our cultures. Things that are exportable, right? If you think about arts, for instance, right? You know, arts in the African content should not be limited to craft.
Yes.
You know, arts is a much, much broader subject matter. It's probably more sophisticated in many respects, right? But we haven't fully represented that on digital platforms for people who are that way inclined. Also, when you think about just general, let's call it social, you know, challenges and things that people are concerned about, you know, whether it's you know, how to access rural communities, you know, with the relevant types of services and services like, you know, antenatal type of services or even just general social services. The way that you deliver those services in Africa has to be different to the rest of the world because that's not the same, right? So there's a myriad of things that I think we can do to influence the rest of the world in terms of the potential for how you can innovate around some of the challenges that are sometimes unique to our context.
You've decided to partner with government and work with technologies and you know, universities and technicons, you know, and mm-hmm. this is around building sort of AI models and working with them. How important is that? Because, you know, one would think that you want to start at grassroots level, but you seem to have taken it a step higher. How was that decision made? And is there still an opportunity to perhaps then go into grassroots levels, especially from a training and a skills development perspective?
No, actually, we've taken a multi-pronged approach, McFarlane. So last year, we actually started a very concerted endeavor to target over 240,000 primary education, you know, learners. And we had partners that we appointed through Google.org with obviously grant funding to help them actually you know, in a train-the-trainer type of approach, get to schools, identify the right champions, and make sure that we equip them with the right skill set to be able to take full advantage of this. Moreover, I think with the primary education space, if I can stay there a little bit, it's super important because kids are adopting these technologies. And then when they bring them into the classroom and the teacher is ill-equipped to deal with it, we've seen a lot of the trending videos and the disruptive nature of these technologies when it's not addressed or even shunned in the teaching and learning process. So that's part of what I think the objective is, to find ways in which we can create a happy medium for teachers to feel empowered, but at the same time, for students to learn in a way that is familiar mm-hmm. in their day-to-day lives, because they use a lot of social media. So if we can strike that balance. For tertiary education in particular, it's the area of research. It's the area of research, and a lot of the academia are also critical, also in influencing policy. We've seen some of the, let's call it the missteps, and therefore we will want to make sure that
the AI-generated AI policy.
I didn't want to say it, but you put it there. So
yes,
it's that kind of thing where I think we have to be front-footed. Ordinarily, on a regular day, legislation does trail the pace of tech evolution, mm-hmm. but we want to make sure that our government and our state is best advised and best equipped to be able to A, take advantage of it, and B, to legislate in a way that that promotes as opposed to constrain.
Something very important with what you're saying is the fact that we also have a huge cohort that is left underprepared, mm. right? And I think what would be important is how do we now also pull those back? Yeah. When you speak about this, the sort of skills deficit that we have in this country, yeah. we've got lots of graduates, we've got lots of, graduates that are looking for work. And we almost say that, there are those that are still looking for work, those that have given up, whatever. There's some sort of thing, measurement that they use.
Exactly.
But it's those that are very important that we need to try and save, because the world is moving at a very, very fast pace, and they might not be able to catch up. As you said, a child is going to walk into the classroom with all of this technology, a laptop, a tablet, a phone, using AI, using Gemini, whatever, and then goes to a teacher that doesn't even understand, where to begin. Yeah. How do we save that? Because that's where our biggest problem is, because the world is not going to wait for them.
Precisely. And one of the big endeavors around that is what we did at the beginning of last year, which was to make Gemini freely available to students and graduates from that perspective, and so that they can use the tools, right?
Yes.
We made that available for a year. I'm keen to actually see if we cannot influence another sort of phase of that. We're kind of working on that. Watch the space.
Good.
Because the target really is to reach at least a minimum of 3 million, graduates, learners, and students, and that kind of sort of demographic. And the reason for it is this. To your point around the fast pace of tech evolution, the people that are going to really, really thrive in that next frontier are the people who are able to augment their skill set mm-hmm. with technology. It's not actually technology replacing humans. It's going to be the humans who are most apt in taking full advantage of the technology. I'll give you a simple example. I was at a dinner last night. A CEO of one of the large mines, let alone, because we always look at mining outfits mm-hmm. as kind of very, very stoic,
yes.
industrial, engineering.
Yes.
They don't use a lot of tech. He was saying, he was on his trip, commute to the office. He literally exhausted all his tokens for his AI tools, right? Generating infographics, preparing for the presentation that he was going to do, and also doing research on the fly, right? Mm-hmm. And the tool was actually helping him to source the research material,
yes.
referenceable research material, and also making sure that he can present it in a form that's consumable and in graphic images. That's what's happening. CEOs, and this is a guy who's not a spring chicken, right?
Yes.
And he's already adopting at that pace. And he was saying, now the question he's asking himself is, what would it have taken for him to synthesize the same amount of information, and how many resources? He would have had to, get an analyst. He would have had to get a legal person. He would have had to get a... And what are those people doing mm-hmm. to actually keep themselves relevant in this age? The genie's out of the box. And the question is, how are you actually going to take advantage of this?
We rank very low when it comes to sort of global digital competitiveness, right? Is there a gap that we're not speaking about? I mean, the example that you just gave now just illustrates how quickly the world is moving. Yeah. Number two, how adoption needs to happen at a very, very fast pace, because what he's doing is being done everywhere else in the world.
Right.
Yet we still have kids that are sitting in class going, 1 + 1 = 2, still writing on a chalkboard. Yeah. You still have teachers teaching in that way. Where is the biggest gap that needs to be filled? And, you know, for lack of a better word, how can we use technology to advance it? Because we can't afford to stay behind.
Yeah, and you speak into a subject that's very close to my heart. So one of the first things that I think still remains a big challenge is the affordability of these digital platforms. So we need to continue to, you know, partner, and we do partner with a lot of the, you know, the ecosystem players in this space around device affordability, and also making sure that access from, let's call it the applications themselves, you know, the AI models, et cetera, is affordable and lends itself to, to be accessible to across the demographic range, right? That's the first thing. The second thing we spoke about, which is about skills and training and being intentional about that. And I think the more of us industry players who can kind of make an impact in that space, the better, right? The third element is something around access, which is around accessibility.
Yes.
Right? The accessibility part, I think, is that equation is being solved, because the barriers to how you interact with technology. Earlier, we were kind of chirping about Gogo sending a voicemail on WhatsApp, right? Like, Gogo can send a voicemail on WhatsApp. Gogo doesn't have to learn how to type anymore.
Yes.
Right? That's the accessibility thing. It's a very small thing, but it's very profound, mm-hmm. because they can communicate now, and technology is no longer intimidating, especially to people who are, I don't know if it's affectionate to say baby boomers,
yes.
you know, the baby boomer generation. But that those are some of the things that intentionally we are focused on.
I mean, it would be wonderful to get to a point where you say, hey, Siri,
we are there.
Go to Sazwa.
No, but we are there.
You know what I mean?
We are absolutely, absolutely there. And it's great that you bring that up. Actually now, because of multimodal AI, you can interact with AI with voice commands, with, you know, text, you know, it's all of that about, you know, and some, you know, video, etc. And the mechanism with which you interact with AI, because it's conversational, it can understand. The more we can localize, and then it understands the nuances of tone and our voices and how we articulate speech, the better. And these are getting better and better as we progress.
This big fear that everyone has, and I'm hoping that you can be able to demystify it, right?
Yeah.
There's two things, right? There's a lot of optimism about AI creating jobs, creating the next jobs.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of fear around AI taking jobs, many jobs. What's the honest reality? You know, because, you know, you look at a lot of, even, you know, we do some work in government, and and there's this huge fear of adopting technology, because the unions are coming out and saying that, hey, you're going to lose jobs.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
then on the other hand, there's all of this new jobs that are being created as a result of artificial intelligence and technology. But what's the honest reality about where the world is actually going?
Look, the reality is, with every evolution, there is a transformation in terms of the work environment, right? It goes without saying. And to our earlier discussion, the trend that we're seeing now, more often than not, is how humans are augmenting themselves and actually accelerating the pace at which they can deliver the same amount of work from an efficiency perspective.
Yes.
As well as the efficacy of what they do, right? So the augmentation piece is happening. There will be jobs that, you know, if you read any of the sort of World Economic Forum type of, you know, reports and studies, you'll see, like, there is an evolution in terms of the type of work that used to exist, you know, like 2 decades ago, a decade ago, and even 5 years ago, versus the type of work that will be mainstream, right? The fortunate part is that there are jobs which have been created. Like, for instance, things like whoever thought prompt engineering could be a thing, right?
Right.
and now companies are looking for prompt engineers because the prompt engineer doesn't only have to be able to prompt a model, but also needs to do it in a way that they create the right context. There's a discipline around how you prompt so that you get the best results.
Of course.
Out of an AI tool. So those types of things, the creative industry actually stands to shed some, but also create new jobs.
Benefit the
right?
most, yes.
Because when you think about production, for instance, and how you iterate in doing kind of a video production, you can get to an outcome a lot quicker. Like your beta version or version one production can be delivered in much faster sort of time frames. And also
cut and paste the video. No, get CapCut. Yeah. Edit, watch, exactly. Press. There, 2 minutes, it's out.
Exactly. It also lowers the barriers to entry, which is important because for the aspirant, media personnel and, producers, etc., they can get into this industry without having to set up massive, massive infrastructure and look for capital investment to do that. So there are pros and cons, and I think the gives and gets. There's a piece of this which is legitimately some jobs will become irrelevant. There's a piece now we're living through which is, does anybody still kind of look for, look to hire a typist, a typewriter?
No, people
don't do that anymore.
Think about an agent, right? For a travel agent, it's now maybe it needs to evolve to a point where they've got to be bespoke.
Yeah.
Where there's certain things that you want that only another human being can interact. But I can get onto my phone now and say, I want to go to such and such a place. I want to stay in such and such a hotel. I want to go do these specific activities, whatever. Press enter, and I've got my entire itinerary worked out for me, and I know exactly where I'm going, what time, what the prices are, et cetera, et cetera. And that then says, when you're sitting there and you're a travel agent, you're like, shit, do I really still have a job, or how do I now evolve, right?
Exactly. And the evolution piece is the key piece, because I still use travel agents because they bring something which is actually nuanced. They bring experience into the equation. So the efficiency of getting you a quote to the point you've made around, you can prompt an AI model now to just kind of, put an itinerary together and also do comparative pricing. Mm-hmm. But the AI model doesn't know that if you're going to Thailand and you go to this part of Thailand versus Phuket versus this, what are the subtleties, mm-hmm. right?
What people enjoy,
etc. How's the environment? Is the place still, you know what I mean? So those types of that sort of insight is not necessarily something that's dispensable.
How do you at Google ensure that you're not just extracting value from, sort of South African markets or even African markets, but you're also genuinely building them and growing them and making them catch up to the rest of the world?
Yeah, a very fundamental question. I think when we set out as part of our Google Africa strategy, we said we were going to invest, and we have been investing. Last year, we officially launched our Google data center, cloud data center, in the region. It's the first of its kind across the African market, and it services Africa. Of course, as demand for it grows, we will continue to look at how we expand that. So it's the technology is here, it's resident, it's local, right? So not consuming offshore, you're not leveraging offshore. the other piece was around connectivity and establishing connectivity infrastructure that covers, the entire coastline of Africa, east and west. And to that extent, we have actually made significant investment, because when you make connectivity infrastructure pervasive, you lower the barriers to entry, by reducing costs. And that's important to the earlier conversation. So those investments, they pay multiples in dividends in terms of, the ease with which people can access the technology, but also the experience that people have of these technologies. Today, a lot of streaming services ride on the you know, on the back of that connectivity, yes. right? The experience you have watching, you know, streaming services or, you know, the soccer, the FIFA, you know, Football World Cup now, yes. you know, is a good one. You don't have the pixelated image. Yeah, it's not buffering. It's a good experience. And that's because of those types of investments, yeah.
Finally, what does it take on a daily basis yeah. to stay grounded and clear? Because your role carries a huge responsibility, especially in South Africa, but also for a company that has a lot of influence on millions of people, yeah. And especially how they then interact with technology. How do you stay grounded? Do you realize the enormity of the position that you're in and the impact that it has on society?
Yeah, absolutely. They say, "Weary is the head that wears it," right? Yes. So, but what does help is to just, you know, be focused on doing meaningful, impactful work and focusing on that, right? There's obviously always going to be a commercial aspect to it. But if we do meaningful, impactful work, like, for instance, lowering barriers to access to technology, helping with enabling, you know, skills, awareness, you know, developing that, we are very focused on SMEs, right, and enterprise development, you know, to make sure that SMEs fully leverage and benefit, because they actually stand to benefit the most, because they don't have the latitude of, you know, a lot of, you know, hands to help them. They're the accountant, they're the salesperson, they're the manufacturer, all wrapped in one. And if technology can enable them to be more successful and thrive, we need a lot of small businesses. I think that goes without saying. Another aspect is how we then make sure that South African companies, which, you know, drive employment, but also contribute to national, you know, fiscus and well-being, are globally competitive organizations. They don't get left in the Stone Age. It's an important aspect. There's a commercial function to that, but also there's a global competitiveness yes. aspect to it, which is key. Last but not least is, you know, there's a lot of creativity, you know, in South Africa, let alone the continent. A lot of creativity. Platforms like the one we are leveraging now, you know, give you instant access to, you know, north of, you know, 2 billion eyeballs, yes. right? So you can put out your mixtape on YouTube and it reaches yes. over 2 billion
of course.
Users at an instant. It's something that was previously unfathomable,
yes.
right?
I mean, you look at people like, DJ Waffles. Yeah, you look at someone like Waffles and they've just blown up internationally. And you're right, it's platforms like this that give hope to an African child to dream.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think also it's important to also recognize that Africa needs to, you know, solve African problems, and through solving problems, create enterprises that are locally relevant, and to popularize those enterprises, to make them kind of internationally known, you need platforms, and platforms have scale and can reach a lot more bigger audiences.
Kabelo, thank you so much. Thank you for the frank conversation on Be Frank with Mac. All the best in your role. And, you know, it's we're inspired when you see the kind of work that you do, the organizations that you work with, because once again, it gives us that hope to say that we are part of this, you know, evolving world. And hopefully we can play some sort of small role to also make a change and a difference, especially in those spaces where technology can't even reach.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, McFarlane. It's been an absolute joy, pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.